Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill, and today I've got as my guest, filling into Rebecca, for Rebecca, Book Riot editor Danica Ellis. And I dialed up, Danica, a solid gold week of real hard-hitting industry news. And I'm not joking. We've got real industry stuff to talk about.
I appreciate here. That. Makes
yeah,
it
you really get to. You really get, I know. You know, we don't have to gin up like, oh, what are we going to do? It's mid-August, and all we've got is an announcements of the paperback of some book we didn't care about. pretty tough stuff. Danica writes for us, our Queer Shelves, which is our newsletter focused on books by and about LGBTQIA plus folks. Also, the Read Harder Challenge. You are captaining that. Mm-hmm. And breaking news, deals, all the other editorial stuff that goes on here. Welcome back to the show. We're going to start. Well, I'm gonna do a sponsor break here in a second, Danica. But I guess my first question, it's interesting to have you on for this first story. I think we'll start with RuPaul's All Stora. Mm-hmm. Because that is kind of in your even pre-Book Riot wheelhouse of being interested in how to get books by queer people, about queer experiences out there in more publicity.
Yeah.
I'm going to tease the folks with this before the sponsor. What did you make of this story? And I'll do the hit in a minute, but what did you, was your first plus, this is cool or this is weird? Is it about time or what?
I think my first response to many new book things is skepticism.
Right.
I was firmly in the skepticism camp, and not to spoil our conversation, I think I am still there to some extent.
Okay. Yeah, I am too. I think it's really interesting to talk about, but we mm-hmm. hadn't talked at all before, so I was curious to get just your initial reaction. Let's do our first sponsor break, and then I'll tell people what we're both... we have 1.5 eyebrows raised. Maybe we need sort of eyebrow scale for measuring skepticism, but let's do a sponsor and we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away With Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
So Allstore is the name of these, and you cannot see my hands do air quotes because podcasting is an audio medium, online book marketplace called From RuPaul and it sounds like some other people. I don't know what the financial relationship always is. They never tell you who owns what and how this thing came together. But it's online book marketplace, notably not called a bookstore. And I don't know if that's meaningful or not. I keep staring at that like it's the Rosetta Stone trying to parse exactly what that is about. And there's two pieces that are interesting, at least two pieces. But the two headline stories is that it is organized and focused on promoting, surfacing, centering books by different, again, air quotes, communities, because I don't think this is a term of art anywhere, but different kinds of communities, especially, I guess we would typically call them or refer to them as historically marginalized communities. So race, gender, sexuality, neurodivergence, what you think that is, there is. And it's an interesting browsing experience. It's a top line navigation you can see, and there's collections there. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it, so that's step one. The other piece of it is a different revenue split with authors. And actually, there's a third thing I forgot. There's a membership piece. But the next piece is a member. Authors will get more if a book of theirs gets sold through Allstore than, I guess, other places. Again, most people don't publish what you get from Bookshop or other places. But they're saying, we're going to give you more of the sale of the book. And then the third thing is, and this is reader-focused, buyer-focused, if you pay us $5 a month, that's what the monthly membership is, you can get discounts on everything. So no membership, no $5 a month. You're paying straight up full freight, full fat retail price for the books. Mm-hmm. If you pay us $5 a month, you can get discounts of between 30 and 50%, which is an interesting deal, right? On a $35 hardcover, that those things can add up. So those are the three prongs of Allstore. Mm-hmm. And there's been a little bit of conversation about the consequence of some of these decisions, but let me get your first take there. Where do you want to start? Which of those is the least interesting to you? Let's go in a sort of interestingness. Danica, you get to pick. What's the least interesting bit of those stories?
I think, honestly, the least interesting part for me is probably the organization and
really?
And
okay.
Yeah, because I've seen, you know, I've seen a lot of sites try to do this. Like, I have seen a lot of queer online only bookshops pop up. None of them have really broken out. Obviously, RuPaul has a huge advantage there of breaking out. But I think it's just something like we've talked about before, where discoverability is just not something that as a reader I'm interested in. I can, I mean, maybe it's because I've spent more than a decade finding queer books, but
it's always hard to know for us, like, are we representative of anything when it comes to a particular use case like this? Yeah,
so that to me is just, I don't know, it's very cosmetic. Like, it would be easy enough to set up a site where, you know, you filter by certain tags and categories and surface these things. So that's definitely, I think, what they're trying to sell, but it's personally not very interesting.
Okay, so that's number three. What's number two? What's the silver medal for?
That would be that authors make more. I think because I immediately think of Bookshop, where they have a kind of similar idea, but for bookstores. If I remember right.
That's right.
Yeah. So this is basically instead of bookshops getting an additional cut with your purchase, authors get an additional cut, which, again, personally, I don't feel like is that big a difference to me. Like, I think either way, you can think of it as, oh, I am doing something a little bit better than if I had been purchasing through Amazon. But I don't have a huge investment in whether the author gets a tiny bit more or a bookstore gets a tiny bit more.
Yep.
I'm not that invested, I guess, between the two.
Well, that's so I covered this in Today in Books quite extensively, actually, for Today in Books. It was the lead story, I think, on Wednesday. And you're keying on to, I think, my central part about this piece of the Alstora story is there's only so many book or there are only so many dollars in a book sale, right?
Yeah.
There just are. And there are companies out there looking at that 25, 30 sticker price for a hardcover, you know, upmarket fiction, let's call that the range, and trying to see if there's a business in distributing that pie differently.
Yeah.
And this has been going on for a while. Quiet as it's kept, the first people to do this were the chain discount bookstores, right? You know what? We're going to give up some of our take, give you a 30, 40% discount, you know, Barnes & Noble in the early 90s or Borders, 40% off new hardcovers to get you into the store. That was a carrot to get you into the store to buy a latte or buy another book or, you know, sign up for a credit card or buy music or, you know, movies, books, and we used to buy DVDs. We used to be a country. and so that was there. It's like, okay, here's a way we can use that margin to do something different than just pocketing it. And maybe that can help us compete. Bookshop has done something similar. You're right. It's like, okay, let's look at the directable, and there's not that many of them because the printing, the distribution, the publisher, they all already have taken, they've already wet their beaks by the time the book is available to buy. Bookshop is saying, okay, we will take less of a margin. We're not going to discount as much. There's a little bit of a discount, but we're going to redirect 5 to 10% depending on the affiliate program and where they come from. It's a little abstruse at this point, but we're going to redirect some of that to an indie bookstore of your choosing. Or if you don't choose an indie bookstore directly, there's a slush fund plus us. A little confusing. And there was a couple other sites that I linked to. There's one called Booksio, which is now defunct, that say a portion of your proceeds go to philanthropy. We're going to give it away to a good cause, right? There's one right now called Tertulia. I'll link to this in the show notes, which they call themselves a reader's co-op online bookstore. And there's a membership as well. And you get a kickback. And if you do enough, you can get a portion. It's like the REI co-op. I don't really understand it. They haven't been really around long enough. But it's the same kind of idea. Is there some way of playing with these marginal dollars that we can get someone to come to us versus, let's be honest, in the United States at least, Amazon to buy their book, right?
Yeah.
Because Amazon is already doing, to the most part, the simplest, which is we sell cheap books, the Joe Fox thing. Mm-hmm. We sell cheap books, come to us. We're gonna redirect that margin to you as a incentive to use our platform. Amazon does a little bit less of that. And so maybe there's some things that happen more. And the other things is most, if not all, and I didn't see confirmation that this marketplace store does this. Most, if not all, of these platforms are using Ingram on the back end. Ingram being, I think, the last juggernaut standing in the physical print book distribution landscape of North America. And they have basically a white label back end that most people can use to order, place, and fulfill. So there is no bookstore behind Bookshop, just if people don't know this. There is no bookstore behind this Alstora thing. There is no bookstore behind. There's a giant warehouse that a lot of different players are getting their books. And not for nothing, for Bookwright's own TBR service, that's where we get our new books. We source them from Ingram and we order them and, you know, we take a little bit of the margin and we do something a little bit different, which is, you know, we use the margin to offer the recommendation as a premium. You pay, you don't get a discount, but you get the recommendation for a little bit of that margin. So there's a lot of ways of doing this. So this is kind of interesting. And then, I don't know, is this going to work? I have no sense of this going to work. And my sense of it is, it sounds like you're a little bit on the same place with me where discovery is not really an issue for me writ large. If anything, I could discover a book or two less a week and be well on my way to understanding how things are put together. And then where people want to put their dollars is, I think, interesting, but I don't see a huge rush to be like, you know what? I've been looking for a place where it more directly serves the authors.
Yeah.
I've been looking for a place where I can go to charity. And I think my sense, and podcast at bookriot.com for those of you out there, my sense is the kind of reader that may be directable cares more about their local indie, if they have one, which is not true for everyone,
right,
than they do about a particular author getting another 75 cents on their paperback. That's just my sense of it. What do you make of that, Danica?
That is kind of how I feel, too. I think it's an easier sell, especially because Bookshop is established. If you are a reader who is actively thinking, where's the best, most ethical place to put my book buying dollar, you're already with Bookshop.
That's so a great point. That's a great way
to put trying it. To convert them from there, right? Like, I think if this is something you are actually considering, you've already found Bookshop. I would be pretty surprised if you hadn't.
Yeah, Bookshop's been very good about getting their name out there. And I think you're right. In the sustainable book buying messaging, Bookshop won that land grab. They put their stake in the ground, and they also have a simpler story, which is don't buy at Amazon. Mm-hmm. Owlstore now is a tougher one because they're saying don't buy a book. I mean, implicitly don't buy a Bookshop, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, at some degree. I mean, it's kind of hard to do that way. So, but I do think this is interesting because it's going to bleed into another story we're going to talk about on the publishing part. Was like people trying to figure out what to do, how to distribute the books per sale, the dollars per sale that are available. Which means then, though, the gold medal to you, and I think for me, I hadn't done this. I made you do this sort of differential on the fly. I think for me, too, this pay for a membership, pay for discounts is the most interesting piece and the most soft-pedaled of this particular story.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell me why you think it's the most interesting piece?
Well, for one thing, this is something I have thought for a while that bookstores should be doing more. It's just if you want to support your local bookstore, that you have a membership that you can buy, and then even if you can just convert that money directly into, like, you're essentially paying for a gift card every month, then you have that reliable income. It makes sense to me to try to have more of a reliable income. But what's interesting about this is obviously they are actually offering something for that. It's not just please support us out of the goodness of your heart. But the numbers make no sense to me. You get 50% off your first three books. For 50% off is a lot. You know, if you're buying a $30 hardcover, you're saving $15 on each. And can you buy those, I'm not sure, all in the same month? And then you're saving $45 for paying $5.
I have to admit, I didn't get down the rabbit hole of how could I game this out. Could I buy my partner's $200 architecture coffee table books all in July, get myself, $200 at discounts and bounce for a $5 out-of-pocket subscription? I don't know the answer to that.
It looks like you have to do at least 2 months.
That would make sense.
Commitment. But still, $5 just does not seem like... I guess for me, $5 doesn't seem like enough money to, like, from their side, from the company's side.
Yeah.
I don't know why you wouldn't go higher than that.
That's a great question. Yeah. I'm Patreons and stuff is more expensive than that. And you get a lot less for this kind of creator stuff.
I am wondering, especially because this is coming from someone who's not really in the book world necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, RuPaul has written books and not coincidentally has a new memoir out now.
I did wonder about the timing.
But I'm wondering if, and I don't know if this is right or not, they're thinking this is a gym membership model. This is getting someone to sign up and then they've forgotten that they've signed up and that most of your money comes from people who are not using the service. And I can see why you would think that, because reading is in a similar way something that people aspire to more than they actually do.
That's right.
But I don't know if it'll work. Like, I don't know if that person who says I want to read more this year is going to sign up for this service. I don't know.
I think there, you could also have a high school football player at the all-you-can-eat buffet problem, which, you got to be careful there, because you could get people who do a lot of reading and book buying and see this as a real angle. Now, having said that, if they have done their math right, maybe they don't care, Danica, because maybe they've built into the price you're paying even, okay, maybe we're not making any margin on that 30% off hardcover you ordered, but we're not losing any money because we pegged it to exactly what it cost for Ingram to get it to your door. Because that's kind of what it is. It's kind of the Ingram pricing, and I've looked at this a little bit, I don't think these are trade secrets, but I won't be specific, is like you've got about 30 to 40% of the cover price to play with. There's some shipping, tax, picking, that's getting the book actually off the shelf and into a box and out the door.
Right.
But there is, if they want to charge 70% of the retail price, I think they break even on that transaction. I think that's what's happening. So the first two, they'll take a wash on, but that's, you know, cost of customer acquisition. Maybe they don't mind so much about that. But if you order 50 books, they don't lose any money, and at least they pick up the five of margin.
That's a good point. Yeah, they don't really have overhead to worry about.
Yeah, right.
Which actually leads us really well into the controversies, if you want
You sent a link, and I hadn't seen this today. I'd already written Today in Books. So once I write Today in Books, I check out on Book News until the next day. You can miss me with any. And Danica's like, well, actually, there's a little controversy. It says, I'm going to read the headline and try to guess what the controversy is. RuPaul's new bookstore dragged for selling controversial books as a piece in Vulture. We cannot fight the ideologies of hate if we lack the ability to study, understand, and react to them, Alstor's team said in a note on a site. So, okay, so the headline here is clearly like, we're here to do good things for marginalized people, but there's controversial books being sold. Mm-hmm. I am guessing the problem here is, once you hook yourself up to the Ingram Borg, you do not get it. Well, let me put it this way. It is very difficult to hand select what you will and will not sell. So you're plugged into the Borg, and you can search for, well, people can figure out the kinds of things you would search for. Maybe there's specific titles here that just show up. Because you're not a bookstore. You're a front end for a database of books.
Yeah,
is that it? Am I close?
You're right on it. There's a TikToker. One of the things that really took off was this particular TikTok from someone who runs a lesbian bookstore who called Alstora a drop shipping operation with a kind of veneer of progressivity over it, which is really interesting to me because I can understand that. And at the same time, like the bookstore I worked at, they plugged themselves into Ingram and Rancos. Like it was, it's a,
this is probably still true at bookshop. You could probably do anything you did here that you do at bookshop.
So on the one hand, I'm like, this really isn't that unusual or controversial to just carry everything that Ingram stocks because it's pretty hard to, apparently Alstora says they offer 10 million titles. Are you going to be sifting through all of those and picking, even if you can delist them, like picking those out? Or are you going to, from scratch, decide how many titles in the world you want to carry? Like, I think that I don't know because I can only really draw on my own bookstore's experience, but it seems like that's the more common thing is to just plug in your, you know, in Canada we do Raincoast and then we also do Ingram, and then whatever they offer shows up on your site. So on the one hand, I feel like the criticism is a little over the top in terms of that because it's a logistical nightmare to try to do otherwise. On the other hand, their defense of saying, you know, we don't ban books and we need to learn from the other side, that I think is also not legitimate.
I do think it's a garbage argument.
Because they're comparing themselves to like university libraries. Well, university libraries aren't offering authors twice as much money for each sale. Right. You know, like you can't really say on one hand, we're a great site because we give authors more money. And on the other hand, say, well, we will offer any author, any hateful author, a place on this site.
And double the royalties for those authors.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and this is one of those cases where the truth is both less interesting and not as exciting as, this is the tool we have to make the books available. We cannot practically, we can't even really impractically demote, cover, get rid of, delist some of the books that we wouldn't want to have any part with. But in order to do what we want to do, which is to surface voices, this is sort of the deal we have to make. This is the tool that's available to us. So at least we're doing this part. No one is doing anything about that other part. And we're like that as well. Maybe they could say something like, you know what, we're going to take a look at some of these. Email us at, you know, publicrelations@alstora.com and we'll take a look on a case-by-case basis. But the truth is that this is the tool available to us and this is how we're choosing to use it. And I can get, you know, I can understand people thinking that's hypocritical. We don't see another way we can make this happen at all. And I, you know, I don't, you're not going to shut up people, but it's not going to seem, I feel like a little gaslit, I guess, not to use a term that I don't quite use that often, especially for myself. It feels about like, is that really why you would do it? So you're saying if there was a button you could press tomorrow that would get rid of all these crappy Nazi books, you wouldn't press it because you're a university? I don't believe that for one goddamn second. I think if they could press a button, they would.
And I think it leads back to this idea of, like you said, it's less, it's both less good and less bad than it's being professed to be.
Right.
Because, like, to be honest, this does not add much to the world to say, hey, I am going to offer all the same books you can get on Ingram, which many, many bookstores around the world do, but especially in the US. But you can do it through my website, my fancy website. I have new graphics. Like, that's, yeah, you've got the membership model and you've got the, like, I'm going to pay authors more, but to me, like, that's not really that much of value. And I think that the whole reason, like, I think part of the reason they're defending this so hard of we're going to carry all the books is because that's the, the only way they're going to do this is that it's very easy to put up this website when you're carrying all the Ingram books. It would not be the same value proposition if you started to have to actually curate what you're stocking and not just what you're, you know, putting it on a list on the front page.
Yeah, and it's almost like there's they've got three value propositions and there's a degree to which they're competing with each other, it feels to me. Like, if you're going to have, if you want people to pay $5 because they could buy any book at 30% off, you got to carry any book, right?
Yeah, that's
true. And that gets in the way of the, because there's a version of this is, we're just paying authors double royalties and there's no membership and there's no inclusionary, I think veneer is too strong, but there's no layer of, you know, having an editorial opinion, right? It's just we're paying authors double and that's what we do. And that would, you know, authors would probably drive people to the site, right? Because it'd be in their interest to do so. And you could see that working. Or you could have, we're like Bookshop, but the thing we do is curate. So we are going to use Ingram's backend. But rather than getting stuff off, we're going to proactively. So we're not going to have everything, but we might have 3,000 books for sale at any given time. And they rotate in and out. But I think all three of them are in competition with each other for what the site is and could be and who it would best serve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it quite works in this version.
It is quite beautiful. Someone put some time into it. It's a beautiful site.
It's not, it's a pretty site. It's but yeah, I think it lacks that clarity of vision that would make it something that would, I just don't see this still being around in a couple of years. This doesn't feel like a lasting.
I think someone's going to try the $5 a month and you get 30%
off.
Someone's going to try that.
I think the membership model is a really interesting one. And I think it's definitely something that could take off, especially if it's paired with some kind of, like, and you can feel really good about where this money is going.
Yeah, but I don't even know that you need to do that. I mean, people shop at Costco not because it's the, you know, the margin on their underwear is going somewhere
great.
Right? I mean, again, I don't know. I think the thing you're competing with in that is it that much better than just buying from Amazon?
Yeah.
Is it that cheaper? Is it that much cheaper, really? Probably
not. It's worth saying that even Amazon doesn't say they'll carry everything. Like,
no,
Amazon
don't.
Is pretty pretty broad about what they will carry, but they do have some lines about things they won't carry.
That's
we
true.
Have seen some books taken down because they got a lot of heat. So in that way, they're being, you know, even more accepting of hateful books than even Amazon.
That's right. We see from time to time. I've seen fewer and fewer stories about it, and I don't know. Everyone's worried about AI, so they're not paying attention to the other evil A. In the media space, I think too, I guess I'm a little surprised that this is the answer Allstore had to this inquiry, because even I, who I'm not in this business, have thought about that when you do these Ingram kind of places, because there are a lot of books, and there's some weird ones, there's some bad ones, there's some harmful ones, and there are a lot, and that's a thin, long tail, and that is hard to prune well, and it's crazy making to do. So I would have been, this does speak to a little bit of not understanding the book industry a little bit, of like what waters you're wading into. I think that point you made about like how many book industry people have, do they have any sense of the topography of the ways and what people are looking for when you come with basically a moral flag waving around? Like, you really got to be prepared to have some stuff ready to say when they're like, by the way, you know, you carry all these Nazi books, right? Because they're available on Ingram. Yeah. And it's like, well, we should study them. My next question would be like, oh, so which of these Nazi books have you studied? Which ones did you
Are you recommending?
Yeah. Which is the best one for me to learn about Nazis? Which of these Nazi books? Which do you think works best? Okay. Let's go to Authors Equity. Then we'll do a sponsor break after the show with a couple other stories. Coming at the same question, the same opportunity from a different side, there's this old chestnut in business speak, which is your margin is my opportunity. Meaning, if someone else has a margin on a product and I'm not interested in that margin, or I can use that margin differently, then I've got an opportunity to compete with you, either on price or some messaging or something else. Authors Equity, which is the CEO is Madeline McIntosh, which was the former CEO of Penguin Random House, who left Random House after the failed acquisition attempt of Simon & Schuster, along with some other industry veterans. So these are, I guess, Danica, what I'm trying to get to our listeners here is, these are serious, top-level, AAA traditional publishing people that are starting this. It's called Authors Equity, and their pitch is not dissimilar, at least in part, from Allstore on the publishing side, which is, we think there's some stuff about publishing that's wrong, and we want to make an author-centered publishing house, and that's going to look like this. First of all, we are not going to pay advances because we want to keep overhead down, but what we're going to do is pay more royalties, a lot more royalties. We don't know how much. I don't know if they're individually negotiated. I've got a million questions about this. And that's great. And we're also going to pay authors monthly. We're not only not going to get advanced, you're going to get paid monthly, I assume, after your book comes out. You're going to start getting a royalty statement with dollars associated with it, versus an advance where you get 15% 2 years after, or 30%, and then 30%, and 30%. It's kind of a mess, and it can take forever. And most people don't earn out. That's the other thing to know about advances. And the reason we can do this is we're going to have lower overhead. And in the piece in the New York Times, the link in the show notes, it wasn't exactly a direct line, but they were next sentences to each other. I wrote about this extensively today in a book, so I read this very carefully. Is that lower overhead was attributed to having the publishing teams for the books be made up of freelancers, from editors to marketers to publicists. And that means the overhead is going to be lower so that we can get a few more dollars out of that $29 hardcover and redirect it to authors. Maybe also we don't have office space. Maybe also we don't have as many middle managers. Maybe there's some other things you can do in overhead. But the one that was cited directly and immediately, at least according to the New York Times piece, is the, I guess, almost exclusive reliance on frontline sort of publicists, marketers, and editors. It's not clear they're going to have... Are they going to have senior editors that are over? Who's overlooking the editorial freelance paper? Don't you have to be an editor to do that? So at least there's going to be some. I don't think Madeline McIntosh is going to be sending out publicity emails for paperback releases. And also, authors can get more involved. You can have a say in how your book is marketed, publicized, sold, packaged, I guess. There's not very many details there. And that's kind of the story of Authors Equity. Danica, which is the most interesting piece to you of this particular story?
Well, let me ask you a question first.
Yes.
Of all these points, can you think of one of them you couldn't also say about self-publishing? Because
well, that's if you want, that is yeah, that is the
if you want
that
no
is the closest analog. Yeah.
And higher royalties, and you want more involvement, and you want to work with freelancers. That sure sounds like self-publishing to me. But with more steps.
There is this class of publisher that they're kind of hybrid publishers. They're self, they will do some of it for you, right? It's like IKEA. You don't build your own furniture. Like, I'm not Ron Swanson out there, you know, getting jack planes out there to making benches, but I'm also not getting it fully delivered to my house. I kind of feel like Authors Equity is the IKEA of publishing. It's packaged and it's easy to assemble, but you're not designing it. You're not doing all that kind of, in self-publishing, you really are. You got to find someone to get the lumber from and do all this and paint it and do all this stuff. This is like, okay, it's kind of ready to go. And we can staff up based on title and opportunity and everything like that. So I think you're not wrong, but I don't think it's, I've seen some other people make that sort of a point. And I think that's a middle ground, right? Where, you know, one of the, there's several high profile authors named in the New York Times piece. They said there are five author investors, but they only named three, which I thought was curious. Tim Ferriss, James Clear, and Louise Penny. James Clear, Atomic Habits fame, said he's publishing all of his new books with Authors Equity. Both Ferriss and Penny say they're going to maybe do some with this, but Penny says she's committed to St. Martin's. I'm not really sure. There's a world, and one thing Rebecca and I have talked about over time, and maybe longtime listeners have heard, is I've always wondered if someone who's a brand name would try something like this, because they already got the benefit of traditional publishing. They have a name. If your name is bigger than the title, publishing has done its job for your career. I'm not kidding about, I mean, it's not to say you could just cut them to wind, but like, that is what publishing is trying to produce. Dan Sinikin talks about this in Big Fiction, of like brand names that can sell titles reliably based on name alone. If you do that, you're like, and I think a lot of these people do negotiate higher royalties. So that's another piece of this I don't quite get. Like, how much higher is it really than if you could get if you are James Patterson at Hachette or other big name authors? I'm not sure about that. Clearly, that was a weird thing to say. Thinks he can get a few more bucks out of it. But he also, his channel is, he has a huge newsletter list. Like, he has a following and a whole marketing thing sort of built in, which not a lot of authors do. But you don't then have to, it's like you then hire the people that hire your people more directly, rather than you walk into a big five office and here's your editor and we're going to take care of all the stuff in the back end and we hope you like your cover. And we're not going to tell you anything about your marketing budget. We're not going to tell you anything about our publicity plans. Again, there's various, there's so many titles and imprints. It's not one size fits all, but you're what I'm trying to get with here. This is one step closer. You get, you can, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's IKEA. It's one of those meal kit home deliveries where you have to cook it yourself. You're not building from scratch, but it's also not takeout. If you're willing to put in a little bit more, maybe get a little bit more out of it. Or maybe you find it interesting or you want more control. It offers you that. And the price you pay is more effort, but also you maybe get a little back end. The piece that I'm most interested in, and I think the bookish internet writ large is most interested, is what does it mean practically for a publisher to be largely staffed by freelancers? You know, what does it mean? Like, how does this work? Is this ethical? I mean, contractors and freelancers, we use them for different pieces. Like, over time, we've tried to rely less on freelancers. We bring you and other people in-house because for reasons that I, you know, don't need to get into here, but that's part of the strategy too. This is going in the opposite direction. And it's especially interesting to see in the light of all the worker empowerment stuff that's gone on in publishing over the last 2 to 5 years, really. I'm not sure. I know they cite that, you know, because of the pandemic and things that have happened of remote work, that people are looking for more flexibility. They don't want to take the F train in to Simon & Schuster 3 days a week, and they can work from wherever. They're not going to have benefits, presumably, and job security and other things that go along with it. That flexibility works both ways, I guess, is one way of putting that. But the other, I guess the meta point for me too, is then where are these freelance publicists, editors, and marketers coming from?
Yeah, because
how do you get them?
They kind of talk about authors will be able to select who they work with, but is that like, here are our three people who could design your cover. Which one do you like best? Or is it, you know, you're trying to wade out into the wide world of illustrator? Because at that point, that again, it's, you're basically back to the self-publishing thing.
Right.
Of, well, I don't know who I should be picking to illustrate my cover. So, yeah, it feels like something that could look very different depending on the model. This is pretty vague.
Yeah, it's pretty vague. And I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of Negotiation is sometimes a pejorative term, but on a case-by-case basis, they may build to suit the contract with the author as they want to build. Like, maybe I do mm-hmm. want final cover design or cover say-so. I know there's a lot of authors out there that love their cover they hopefully get. There's a lot more we don't hear. Not more. But there's also a number that don't love their book cover. Mm-hmm. And they don't have, you know, they don't have final say because they don't, you know, they basically sold the rights to market and package the book. To the publisher, but like, I think, you know, we got a comment, I think it was a good one, saying there's a lot of freelancers out there that were disaffected or because of ageism or other life events that are no longer working for traditional publishers, but they're freelancing, mm-hmm. you know, spent 20 years working in publishing or something like that. But if this model became the standard, there's nowhere to get the freelancer with 20 years of traditional experience, right? It's sort mm-hmm. of the end result of the traditional publishing world having to exist for something like author's equity to exist. There has to be someone who knows mm-hmm. how to edit or market or publicize a book. Unless those, I guess it's possible those kinds of sources would follow kind of an agency model, like a literary agent where they have their own shops with apprentices and other things like that. I guess that would be a counter structure could rise up to meet this on-demand, flexible, not mm-hmm. in-house kind of a staff, but that infrastructure does not now exist, generally speaking. There are PR firms, publicity firms mm-hmm. that specialize in books. I know less about sort of editorial firms or design firms that provide mm-hmm. sort of house services to companies. And I don't know if this is going to take off. I also wonder about what do you do with a debut novelist? What do you do with someone who doesn't have that brand name?
That's what I'm stuck on, is most people don't earn out their advance. And there are a lot of problems with advances in publishing. And I can totally understand people wanting to try something different. But I don't think most authors are saying, man, I really wish I didn't have an advance and I just had more royalties later. I think most authors are relying on advances, even if they're cut up into a bunch of little pieces or even if they're not as high as they'd like. I mean, you're having to write a whole book without getting paid for that until much later. And that's already true to some extent, but you're pushing it much later.
Later and less guarantee, right? Because you have less.
Yeah.
If it's the case that most authors don't earn out their advance, wouldn't the case be if I just did a royalty only deal, I'd make less on average? Because by nature,
that's
you just said
I'm
I didn't
thinking.
Earn out my own advance.
Yeah, so I don't really understand why an author would do this. Because if you've already got the name equity, you really could self-publish. That's a lot of work. Maybe this is to serve that it's just for authors who already are
the 1%.
So established.
It could be. That's a great, I hadn't thought about. Maybe it is sort of a 1% kind of a deal where they've already got some of that groundwork laid and, you know, they don't need
it's like a little
the ground level work.
publisher, where it's not as much work as self-publishing, because you can just hire someone to do all of that work, but you don't have to go through the hoops of the usual publishing industry. I just can't think of any average author who would want to sign up for something that doesn't give them an advance. That's just you need to have a lot of money to play with, basically.
A side gig, or, you know, maybe you want to bet on yourself, which people do. But I think that's an interesting point. Another thing that distinguishes something like this from self-publishing and the imprimatur of the names involved and their industry relationships do matter is, like, if you self-publish, your book is not getting into 1,000 Barnes and Nobles. It's not happening.
Right.
So this will have they will work the phones, so to speak. This is a thing you said, mm-hmm. what, in the 70s, before I was even born, when you were talking about making networking connections and, you know, high-level understandings of the inner workings of how the pipes are put together. They will have distribution deals already in place with Simon & Schuster, right?
Yeah,
so if a bookstore wants to order your book, they only have to go through Simon & Schuster, which is probably Ingram, let's be honest, in most places. We're back to the root of the root. But if you self-publish, you are not going to get Simon & Schuster to put you in their omnibus catalog in Edelweiss and make you available to buy. You're not going to get a meeting with the buyer for Costco about why they should carry your book. It's not going to happen.
That's fair. Yeah.
So again, but that's a one percenter problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or opportunity cost to do it some other kind of way. I don't know. I mean, I find the whole thing very interesting. There's, as we might imagine, I think this is worth mentioning too. I'm sure Book Talk is having its own experience, but on the Twitter and Blue Sky sphere, a lot of relying on freelancers feels like a step backwards for the industry at writ large, especially for the labor force. And when it feels like over the last couple of years, some things have been gained. And workers have flexed their muscles, and there have been costs and layoffs because there's higher costs. Maybe we should just be printing fewer books so people aren't overworked. I think those are all conversations worth having. But it feels hard for someone to get a leg up in the industry, to have an entry-level position that can populate like this, if this becomes a competitive model that the Simons and the Hachettes and the, you know, the FSGs have to compete with to some degree, to get authors to sign up, because then the marginal dollars are coming from the benefits for full-time employees and flowing towards authors. And maybe that's okay, or not okay. Maybe that is something people would be willing to stomach or deal with, or it's just kind of moving the risk around a little bit. Because one thing I said in Today in Books, which I believe to be true, is there are more people making full-time lives working in publishers putting books out than there are actually writing books. There's very, very few people that make full-time living off actually writing the book. Now, writing the book is only part of publishing a book, but an important part, of course. But maybe the dollars have flowed too much towards the bureaucracy of the publishing world. I even as I say that, I don't believe it. But you know, you could see a counter argument. It's like, okay, if there's only so many dollars to go around, and authors are the most important part, they call it an author-centered publishing house, so they're not, you know, they're not prevaricating or anything there. That means we want to try to flow more dollars there. Does that mean the executives are going to get paid less if they had an equivalent job somewhere else? I think that would be a fair question to ask. I don't know. But there's only so many dollars in the book buying. That's what I'm saying. We're all competing for how are we going to split up that $29 on the book? And this is another way of looking at it. Okay. Anything else there, Danica, you want to say about author's equity? Thoughts, open-ended questions?
No, I think we covered it.
All right. Let's move on. Let's do our second sponsor break, and then a story that was a leftover from last week, which I do want to spend a few minutes on.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge strategy and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Lee and Lowe's Diversity in Publishing report, also an opportune time to talk about this for a few minutes, in which they send out a whole bunch of surveys, I think 24,000 for this one, of publishers, publishing employees of all shapes and sizes across North America. So you may even have some Canadians in here, Danica. They didn't tell us, but you're the maple leaved among us may also be represented. and the top, Erica wrote a really good piece for us. I'll link to it again. I think I linked to it last week, which I thought was interesting. My top level note, and I included in Today in Books, was, you know, the metric I've been looking at for 10 years in publishing is what percentage of the respondents, and Lee and Lowe's been doing this since 2015, I think is the first one. I think it's the first one I saw, self-reports as white. That's the one that leads all of these. When we Book Riot, the early days of talking about diversity in publishing, it was certainly race-based. And I think it still remains a central piece, but it's expanded in the Lee and Lowe here. And by that measure, the self-reported measure, publishing is less white than it was the last time they did this. Going from, oh, I lost my number. Do you have the number in front of you? I just lost my tab there. 70.
I know it's 72.5 now.
Yeah. From 79 in 2015.
Right. Yeah.
So that's 6% in absolute terms, but closer to 10% in relative terms. Percent and percentage is always fun, and I get it wrong all the time. But we've moved from 79 to 72. Now, you might be saying, probably rightly so, well, it's still 72%, Jeff. Is that great? I don't know that it's great. It's an improvement. It's taken 9 years. That's a long time. I guess it's also important to know, and I link to this in Today in Books, like, what are we comparing it to? Is it great on an absolute term? What do you look? What's the goal here, right? And one goal we might think about is, do the people working in publishing, or any industry for that matter, kind of represent the people that are here in North America, the U.S., whatever you know baseline you're comparing it to? And in that regard, according to the 2020 census, and again, the reporting, the tick boxes don't line up neatly, so there's some fuzziness in it, that 75% of people, of you American citizens filling out the census, reported as white, non-Hispanic, which looks like it's the closest one here. So by that measure, the publishing industry is less white than the United States population at large. And I want to be very clear about this. I do not think this is cause for mission accomplished. This is not mission accomplished across an aircraft carrier. That's not what I'm saying here. But I would say that's a noticeable benchmark to cross. Mm-hmm. Before we get into some of the steps, does that mean, Erica, and I guess, not to quote, not to put Erica's words into my mouth, she's looking more deeply. There's also stuff about colorism, biracial and multiracial is a checkbox here. Also, where are these people in the pecking orders? Are they executives? Are they junior? Which kind are they? Are they working in production, editorial, which tends to be more prestigious? Those are all kinds of questions that are really interesting to look at. But that was one of the top lines to me. But I think there's a bunch of any interesting things. So that was my number one thing that I was looking at. It's like that's a line that's been crossed in at least one aspect. There's still a lot of work to do, and you know, I don't. Again, this is not mission accomplished. Don't hear me say that. But that's a notable benchmark to see. Where else would you like to point these stats? What else do you want to highlight in these stats, Danica?
Yeah, I think the intern part is really important because the interns, 63.8% identify as BIPOC. So yeah. Almost a flip of the
almost
ratio.
Almost a flip, yeah.
And it's definitely worth pointing out that this is also the section where are these people being paid at all? How much are they getting paid?
Right.
Like that is pretty significant. And I keep thinking about 2020 and how all the, and I think this is something Erica was talking about too, all the promises that were made during 2020 of big changes. And I can understand maybe at that point in 2020, you brought a bunch of interns in to try to change, you know, especially in terms of Black representation in publishing. But it's been 4 years now. And if they were interns in 2020 and they actually stayed in the industry, then they should have moved upwards by now.
Yeah, and to a junior position, you would think, like retention, I guess, is the point you're making. Like how many of these people were brought in an effort to get people onto a ladder got to rung number two? I think that's a very fair question.
It is, like, if you look at editorial, which I think is probably the most likely, you know, place that people would have moved, it has changed. It went from, 85% white in 2019 to 71.6% white last year. So that is a big change, and maybe that is what happened. It's hard for me to really.
It's hard to say.
That's complicated math to know, like, what would be the correct shift and how many people move from interns into the industry. But it does feel wrong to me that the vast majority of these people are in the internships when you're looking at BIPOC workers in publishing. that.
Yeah, I don't know in percentage terms it's flips, but I don't know how, like, as a percentage of all workers, how what percentage do interns make up? There's something we don't know here.
Yeah.
But I think what we can say is that those interns slash getting ready to be entry level positions are seemingly the most racially diverse part of publishing. And it would make some sense for that to take some time to for people to climb ladders.
Yeah.
I think it's it would be wonderful to know, are those people who are coming to the publishing industry that aren't white, are they climbing the ladder at the same pace as their white counterparts?
Right.
Right. And that we can't divine from this, but it's it's an open question at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that jumped out to me, the biggest change from is the sexual orientation wheel here. In the most recent, 68.7% of respondents responded as being heterosexual, which is quite a bit less than the U.S. self-reporting population at large.
Yeah.
Quite a bit less. And I would guess the 14% who identify as bisexual / pansexual is quite a bit higher. I am less in tune these days with how people are self-identifying and, you know, everyone call, do what you want. I'm all for this, but that number really surprised me, but I haven't seen a demographic breakdown about sexuality sexual orientation in a long time that I paid attention to like this. Did any of that strike that as surprising, or did that make sense to you?
I guess it made sense to me. It really depends on age, like from what I've seen of these answers, is that if you ask, you know, teenagers today, then they far more of them will identify, especially as bisexual, than if you ask, you know, 40-year-olds. Like, that's
right.
So I think I expect that publishing, especially when you're looking at interns, is fairly young. Maybe I'm getting that completely wrong. But
well, there's a world in which those are correlated, is what you're saying. Like, there's a world in which some of that's correlated. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think if that internship, if the you know, if there is a significant portion of the people answering that are in their 20s, then that doesn't really surprise me. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of think that artsy professions, that's kind of lines up with what I think, but obviously
it's biased. Well, it's just so different than 2015, which I think it was like, was it? It was 84%. So it could have been young.
Yeah.
I mean, 9 years is a long time, and if there's a bunch of new younger people and people, who knows? Maybe there were different. There weren't even these checkboxes available in 2015, and people feel more comfortable saying who they are and what they want to be identified as, which is all wonderful. But that was the wheel that jumped out to me to having the biggest change, except of course work location, which is again, no one would have anticipated the world we've entered in now. 48% of respondents say they work in hybrid, remote and in office. 45% remote only, and 6.7% in office only. And I can tell you, having been in big time publishing office buildings over the last 6 months, that feels right. These places are tombs, baby. They are empty. And I'm there on busy days. Like when we go for sales or other kinds of meetings, we're like trying to be there on Wednesday. And it's still like, where is everybody? And maybe that's what Authors Equity is trying to do. It's like, we don't have a lease in one of these giant midtown office buildings.
Yeah.
But that is really surprising to see. I guess I was expecting it more like to be 60-ish% hybrid. I was not expecting 45% remote only.
Yeah, that's surprising to me too.
Yeah. And then gender, this one's sort of held steady. 71% of people responding to the survey identified as cis women, which has been the publishing and book world for quite a long time. Little bit of movement, not there. So I guess if I had to say a story, like I'm connecting the dots 2015 and 2013, Rebecca and I were talking about this after we recorded last week. Like if you had showed us to this in 2015, what would have been like, we're making some progress here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that. Because on the other hand, it feels like a long time. On the other hand, the world is hard to change. And it is somewhat changed, Danica. It just is.
It's true.
It is somewhat changed. If it stops here, I think that will be a problem. But I could imagine in another 9 years, these numbers moving slightly. Because people that work in these industries typically stay there a long time. And it takes some time to repopulate with different kinds of folks in there, which if you've managed to stick around, and if you're an intern, good luck to you. Hold on. Mm-hmm. I know it's not an easy gig there. Okay. I think that's all I had to say there. Oh, my favorite thing. You get to talk to me about audiobook pricing. Are you ready for this? You know how excited I get about audiobook pricing.
Yes.
Let's I don't know your audiobook. What's your audiobook hygiene regimen? What do you do audiobooks at all, Danica? I don't think I know this.
I don't pay for audiobooks. I do library and I do advanced reader copies and that's
you
all.
Are the 1% when it comes to audiobooks. It's digital audio copies in the Canadian library system. Welcome. Yeah, we can all be jealous of Danica too. We should do an expose of the digital audiobook galley system. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's
really
a different. It's not an. It's confederated and DRM, and it's annoying. This one got me shaking my eyebrows, to coin a malapropism here. Spotify has introduced the audiobooks access tier, which includes 15 hours of audiobooks, and it is $9.99. So, which is a dollar less than the premium, which gets the same 15. But you lose, for that dollar, the ability to listen without ads to music and podcasts. Audiobooks do not have any ads at this point in Spotify. That at this point was meaningful. I know nothing except how these things tend to go. This is really weird hair splitting for me to do. Mm-hmm. How many people out there is like, you know what, I'm really into this Spotify thing, but I need to save a dollar so I don't listen to ads. But I do want the audio. I think this is a very strange. They must have seen something. I do not get this one iota. Explain this to me, Danica, like I'm a 9-year-old. What am I not seeing here?
I mean, I can only think that they're not going for Spotify people. They're going for Audible people.
Yeah.
And they're saying,
which is this is already cheaper than Audible though. Audible's $14.95 for one audiobook credit.
But $10, that's a nice round number. Or
price point less than
$10. $10. That's like one of those weird, you know, customer things where you're like, $10? That's
anchoring.
Almost a dollar.
Like Roger Sterling says in Mad Men, 99 cents. Someone had to invent that we would do that with pricing.
Yeah.
I guess
so
you're right. Maybe they think that someone hears it's $9.99 and they're not already a Spotify subscriber. Then you're $5 less than Audible.
Yeah, and from there
you can get yourself an Allstore subscription for that $5. You can get them both for the price of one.
And from there, maybe they then roll out. Hey, did you know if you pay a dollar more, you can get all this cool Spotify stuff? Did you know about?
That's right. They can upsell you for $1.
Yeah.
They can advertise to you the non-ad version of what you're getting. I always like that move.
Something's upsetting my dogs out there. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Everyone likes it when the dogs get involved. When the pets and children are always welcome in the background. Yeah, that's a good point.
They're just upset about audiobook pricing.
Yeah. Are they going, is this what they're going to be advertising to people on like Facebook ads? For $9.99, get 15 hours of audiobooks plus music. I hadn't really thought about that. It's a really good point. I also wonder, is it the 15 hours? Like, what percentage of audiobooks are 15 hours or fewer? This is something Rebecca and I have wondered about in the Spotify thing. It's odd. I feel like most are, but there's enough that aren't that feels annoying to me if I was going to make this my paid audiobook service.
I was trying to figure out how you end up with 15 hours. And I feel like all of the, unlike we're talking about, you know, physical books have basically one model of selling and almost everyone's doing the same thing. Audiobooks are the opposite. These are all weird competing models that don't line up. Like, so I get a credit and then I get to listen to your library, but that there's only some books that are in the library and the credit, like it's hard for me to compare the two, the Spotify and the Audible, because they're not using the same units, basically.
So, yeah, you're right. Probably Spotify figured out the median audiobook they had was 16.1 hours. So they were going to have a chance to upsell people or something. Or did they say actually 90% of our books are less than 15 hours? So most people won't be pissed off?
I was thinking that it's probably not about the audiobook length. It's about how much do people listen to audiobooks.
How much, that's right.
In a month.
There you go.
And I was trying to think, like, okay, what is the minimum viable customer for an audiobook subscription? You know, like somebody who's listening to audiobooks, but not a ton. And I'm thinking it's probably during their commute, not that long a commute. What are you listening to, like half an hour of an audiobook?
The average U.S. commute is 21.7 minutes. I happen to know off the top of my head for reasons I don't want to get into. But yes, so you can do 45 minutes a day, 45 times 20. You're looking at pretty close. You know, if you're doing four work weeks commuting, you're getting pretty. Yeah. That's pretty close to 15, Danica. It's pretty close.
This is what I'm thinking, and that person doesn't care if they're they're gonna keep listening to that audiobook the next month, right? Like they're not thinking about it in terms of where the audiobook ends. They're thinking about it in terms of do I get to the end of my commute and still you know, be able to listen to something.
Yeah. They don't care about the high school players at the buffet. If you're listening to seven audiobooks that you're willing to pay for, this is awkward for you.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna do it. That's pretty interesting. Also, I thought you were going to the audiobooks like audiobook deals can be as little as $2.99. And these are from big five. I mean, these are backlist, right? Like deep backlist. But these are, you know, it's going to be David Grand's first book. You can get those for $2. All the way up to a new release, Barbra Streisand, 7,000-hour audiobook that's like $50. That is wild to me. That's wild to me. No, and I guess books are sort of priced like that. But the variance isn't as huge. You're not getting a non-remaindered print book for anything even close to $3. And again, print books are different, but the experimentation is quite a bit interesting. I haven't seen any Audible moves. I haven't seen anything that Audible has done that feels like a direct reaction to anything Spotify is doing. And I keep waiting for something like that to happen. So another wrinkle there. I mean, maybe this is a great, you know, Mother's Day, Father's Day, dad's grad thing. You have a parent that likes to listen to audiobooks. But it's $10. They don't want to use Libby or what do you have? What's your audiobook? What's the Canadian audiobook platform? Do you all use Libby up
still
there
Libby.
Too? Or still Libby. And you don't want to wait. You know, if you have a that's the other thing about audiobooks in libraries is you can get a hold on there for a long time. That's what gets me to pay for audiobooks.
Yeah.
Is that if you wait for something. But there's that. If you can beat Danica's idea that this is for people not in the Spotify ecosystem and they're hitting a price point, not a feature set. Say if you're right, podcast@bookriot.com, or I would love Little Birdies. I got a Little Birdie email this week, so good, Danica, and it said this is anonymous at the beginning. I can say nothing about it, but I want to say to this person, thank you so much, and I will be sharing it privately with people here. And I will send it to Danica right after this because I didn't share it with her. And that's what we call a tease. I can't even put that on the Patreon, Danica. That goes nowhere. That's horrible. That's bad podcast. That's bad podcasting ethical stuff. I don't know what to say about that. Danica, thank you so much for joining us. Queer Shells will be linked in the show notes. Read Harder Challenge, a link in the show notes. First edition. Speaking of technology, back on the saddle with First Edition. We're going to be doing two episodes a month on the first and third Thursdays. I had one in the can I needed to clear out. Jason Snell of Six Colors came on to talk to me about the state of the e-reader. Not e-reading, the physical device of the e-reader. Ooh. I've been reading him for a long time, writing about e-readers. So that's interesting too, but we're going to be back with First Edition a couple times a month now that I'm over COVID and the Book Riot podcast is on its new accelerated cadence. I got my feet under me a little bit, so look for stuff there. You can follow Rebecca's writing Better Living Through Books. There'll be a link there. We're taking turns writing today in books. Book Riot Podcast Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. We'll be taking to calling this the BRP EU, Danica, the Book Riot Podcast Extended Universe, all these other things that go into it. I feel like there was something else, but we talked last week about the Book of Love by Kelly Link. And then next week, I don't remember what we're doing for the Patreon, but we're going to be talking about the best books about publishing next week on the occasion of American Fiction. Maybe having won the Adapted Screenplay Oscar. We shall see. Thank you all so much. Danica, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks. See ya.